I'm going to continue talking about the de Broglie-Bohm model. And the issue I want to look at next is how measurement pans out. Remember I said one of the important issues is whether the any given interpretation solves the measurement problem. So let's see how this works in the de Broglie-Bohm model. So imagine we have some system, a single particle. I'm just going to give you a simple example. So imagine we have a system, a single particle. It's in one dimension, and its wave function consists of two peaks. Which are non-overlapping. So we write the wave function as this. And now we can introduce a measurement apparatus. We've a pointer. Which has position y. And it's in some initial state. Phi zero of y. So we can imagine that this is a wave packet that's reasonably narrow, about the zero position, something like that. And such that in the course of the measurement interaction, or after the measurement interaction, we go from the initial, if we have this state, so we have this wave packet impinging on the measurement apparatus. You can think of this as being the case where beta is equal to zero. So this is the evolution according to the unitary Schrodinger equation. So what happens is that the pointer state evolves to some new position. So you can imagine the pointer just moves to a certain position in accordance with when it sees a wave packet coming in that's peaked around here. And similarly, we have pieces of chalk keep getting smaller. For the B position, we have the same thing. And we demand that this evolution, for this to be a good measurement apparatus, this condition is true. Um, What this means is that in the Y space, the wave packets associated with each of the two incoming states over here on the pointer are non-overlapping. So you can think of this as being a pointer goes from here to here or from here to here. Yeah, exactly. I was just trying to make this point. This is a stronger condition than saying that they're orthogonal. Because, for example, you could have just write it like this. Stronger than that condition. Just to give an example, you can imagine that you had that this state is corresponding to the, say, the first and second excited states of some well, and those states overlap. So if my well, the first excited state, I guess has one, so it's something like this, and the second excited state is, what is that? I think it has. Anyway, you can find orthogonal states which overlap almost everywhere in position space, but they're still orthogonal. And it's interesting in the de Broglie-Bohm model, if you look at detectors which are constructed in this way, so the states are orthogonal, but they're overlapping in position space, then they don't do the sort of thing that you would want them to do. So there is a sense in this model that that you're really making position in the de Broglie-Bohm model that you're really making position special. So experimentally, you could never really see a difference. I think just because in the end, all our measurements are, you know, all our macroscopic measurements do entail having things that are non-overlapping in position. So, but you can use it to set up some strange situations in the de Broglie-Bohm model. Okay. So, in the if we take this initial state that I wrote here and evolve it, then because the Schrödinger evolution is linear, then the wave function, the total wave function for the whole system, for the pointer and the original system, after the measurement, call that time t, is going to be equal to this. Now, if this was the full ontology, we would have the reality problem, the measurement problem, you know, which of these two things actually happens. But here we have the trajectories, a part of the picture as well. And so the idea in the de Broglie-Bohm model is that the trajectories will pick out one of these two terms. And so let's see if I can plot that on a graph. Use more space. So this is the y position for the pointer, for the actual particle in the pointer. This is the x position for the actual particle in the original system. This is time. So let's imagine that the pointer, I'm going to put my zero here for the original position of the pointer. Whereas over here, we have the original position of the two wave packets. So my initial state is a product state of being in a wave packet here, which is just centered on the zero position, and having a superposition of this and this. So the product, the initial state will have support on these two regions. Is that clear? But now we're going to evolve this in time. So we'll evolve this in time. So let me see if I can draw this convincingly. So what will happen is, the wave packet here associated with the A position is going to end up going in this direction in the Y space. So it will end up, let me just draw this into four pieces, it'll end up over here. This is just the sort of, in a sense, the Schrodinger evolution of that particular part of the wave packet, the wave function. And meanwhile, this one will end up coming over here. Okay. So they stay where they are in X space, but they're separating in Y space. And so now, if you have some initial position in your configuration space, your X, Y space, which is over here, your particles, let me draw that in a different color, then it will just it follow the flow of the two wave packets. So wherever your position is, it will stay in the same wave packet. And now, you'll be able to read off the Y position what the X position was. In a sense, what the trajectories are doing is that they're putting a little, dot. They're saying, well, this is the, you know, they basically stay in the term that they start in. And so they provide a definite thing that tells you that you're in this wave function, you're in this term rather than in this term. So that's how the measurement problem is resolved. Now, if the pointer is a very big system, so it has, you know, something like Avogadro's number of particles in it. Then this this condition over here, the one at the top, is likely to remain true for all subsequent times. I mean, that's just a statement about, you know, decoherence, and this is a sort of messy thing. It's very unlikely that you'll be able to make, imagine this dimension really represents 10 to the 23. You really have 10 to 23 different particles here. So then if you're separating these things out in 10 to 23 different directions, it's very unlikely that your Schrodinger evolution is going to bring all those 10 to the 23 different directions back together so the two wave packets overlap. So you're unlikely to ever get recoherence in the pointer space. What that means is that if you see the pointer particle in, say, the A packet, then you can effectively ignore the B packet. Let me just say more carefully what I mean. So the guidance, whatever particle you're interested in, for you know some particle X or Y, so this should be the velocity for whatever particle you're interested in is given, remember, by some function which is determined by the wave function of the position where you are in configuration space. But that function can be written like this, where this is an effective wave function. And the effective wave function is given by just this term if y, the actual position of the pointer, is in the support of this A wave packet. And similarly for the B case. So the projection postulate is recovered. So any questions about this? Because this is kind of a crucial part of the model. Yep.
So in this ontology, then, the wave function has these two branches.
Right.
And if we consider the wave function as like a real physical field,
yeah,
sort of comparable to the electromagnetic field, say, both of those branches still exist, but one of them just kind of stops.
Stops affecting the trajectories,
because
yeah.
Because the trajectories aren't, but there's in the ontology, they're still there.
Absolutely, yeah, 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 yeah. No, this is an issue that I'll mention in a few moments, yeah.
So, what happens to the normalization?
Remember the comments I made a few lectures back that you can always choose just to calculate conditional, or you can always choose to calculate joint probabilities. So if from the very beginning you're just calculating joint probabilities, then the alpha squared will give you the right thing, or you can just renormalize. So you divide through. But I guess I've done that here, and the thing. So it's just a matter of whether you're calculating conditional probabilities on your measurement outcome, in which case you'll normalize like I did here.
But you're worried about your particle trajectory involves like a derivative.
Right. Let's just look at the function again. I think you're. Let me just write the function down because I never. Yeah. So that's right. You remember? Yes, it's divided by normalization, so that just goes out. Yeah. As long as that normalization doesn't is flat over the region that you're interested in. Yeah. So you remember it's the imaginary part of something divided by the normalization. Good. Okay. So the De Broglie Bohm model was really written down by De Broglie back in 1927 or something like that. And like the guidance equation was written down by him. But then after that Solvay conference, 1927 Solvay conference, I think he abandoned the model and didn't look at it further. And then it was revived by David Bohm in 1952. But this particular part, understanding the measurement process, is something that David Bohm did in 52. De Broglie didn't do that. And I think it's an essential part of the model to explain how measurement works. Okay. Yeah.
Suddenly these things would come back into effect. But I guess if you're actually doing this in a lab, well then you'll have extra degrees of freedom with like the rest of the laboratory.
Yeah, right.
And suddenly you need to recombine every single one of these degrees of freedom, which is exactly it's not predictable standard.
It's just not gonna work.
It's like thermodynamically impossible,
in principle. Yeah,
so
yeah.
Combine,
that's right, yeah. Yeah, so it's exactly the kind of situation that John Bell was imagining when he said, for all practical purposes, you can never do it. But there is still this, in principle, possibility. Yeah.
But I mean, it's still exactly as pretty, like quantum mechanics still allows for that in principle possibility, unless until you actually conclude the idea of collapse. So there's nothing.
Right.
There's still an agreement there. You can even like imagine an experiment where this would disagree with it.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I mean, the only sort of thing we'd disagree with would be if you had a model where you thought, well, at a certain level, there was collapse. And then he managed somehow, nevertheless, to set up the physical conditions that would recohere those wave functions. And then you distinguish between that and so collapse models are distinguished are empirically testable and distinguishable from this kind of situation. So there's a few more interesting things in the De Broglie-Bohm model. Let me just mention them. I think I already mentioned this, but according to that guidance condition, the velocity of one particle is a function of the positions, the actual positions of all the particles. So the velocity of particle one depends on the position of particle two. So if you could imagine somehow jiggling x2, then you would affect the velocity of particle 1. And x1 and x2 could be very different, could be very distant from one another. So these could be very different positions. It's a slightly difficult question to ask. How do you jiggle x2? Because this is the deterministic model. But you can imagine that you have some Hamiltonian with a potential term and that you're able to change the potential acting on x2. And then you could effectively cause the position of x2 to change. You could jiggle it, and then you'd move x1 as well. So. usually in quantum theory, you imagine varying some sort of potential or something to change a system. And it's exactly this non-locality in a de Broglie-Bohm model that was John Bell's motivation. To come up with his famous theorem. And so, in a sense, you can think that the de Broglie-Bohm model, even if you don't believe it as being a true picture of the world, I certainly don't, it's nevertheless a very good way of motivating questions such as whether nature is non-local or not. Another property it has, as I mentioned before, is that the wave function is a real thing in this model. So that motivates the question, is the wave function necessarily a real thing? And you'll hear about the PBR theorem, which is an attempt to prove that it is a real thing. Yep.
At which point do we...
Sounded like the beginning of an interesting question.
Yeah, I'm still having problems with exactly where kind of the measurement occurs.
Right, okay, yeah, so I can address this issue a bit. I thought that was the question you were going to answer. So the one question is, you know, at which point do you say, well, you know, now we have an outcome. And there's different ways to try and address that. One is to say, well, all we want to do is account for why, at a macroscopic level, we have tables and chairs and so on, behaving like, you know, in the way that we think we have. So in that case, the de Broglie-Bohm model would certainly give you particles corresponding to the positions in, you know, the atoms or not in these tables and chairs, give the right picture. Another approach is to say, is to try to set up what the philosophers call the psychophysical parallelism, to try and say what are the actual features of your model that we see with our conscious minds. And then in this model, you have to say, well, it's the actual particle positions that we see, not the wave function. So our conscious experience corresponds to the particle positions. But you want to be careful that you can't see you know, the detailed particle positions. Otherwise, you would start to see sort of crazy non-local effects. So there is an issue there. And Anthony Valentini, who's done a lot of work on this model, has thought about that a bit.
It's effectively like many worlds. One universe.
Right. So yeah, I'll come to this issue. Yeah.
Tom doesn't believe in consciousness.
Right. That's good. Yeah. Okay. Maybe just one interesting technical point. So on this feature of non-locality, if your wave function for the two particles is a product state,
then you can show that the guidance formula doesn't depend on the position of the other particle. So another point is that although the model is non-local, this non-locality is masked by just by probability. When I say you can signal faster than light, I don't, of course this is non-relativistic quantum theory, so on the basis of that wouldn't be surprising. But here you can imagine two particles that are you know, isolated many, many, many millions of miles away from one another, you know, in infinite potential wells, for example. So we don't have to worry about tails of wave functions. And yet you can still be able to signal faster than speed of light. This is not the kind of thing that will go away in quantum field theory. And indeed, there are quantum field theoretical treatments of this model. We could also have that problem. Yeah.
Saying that rho equals psi squared is saying that our uncertainty of the particle is equivalent to the wave function. So, like, how could we, for us to find like a case of rho not equal psi squared, that means we have to find we have to find a system where we know more information about the particle than what the wave function can give us.
Yeah.
That sounds like at that point you kind of broken quantum mechanics from the get-go.
Right.
That's not sort of like a problem with this model. If you can possibly know more about the particle than the wave function, you're going to have.
Yeah, so it is sort of a problem with the model because it's not a natural thing to assume that it should be driven. Where does it come from? So I'll say a bit about how you can get that. And also, just one aside is actually, even in this process over here, we do have to break that because we end up using the effective wave function. You make an observation, and so you no longer have very precise square to the original.
Would that be a problem for straightforward projection like this? Like, let's say we make a measurement, we find that the particle is in wave packet A. But like you said earlier, wave packet B is still there.
Yeah.
So now my probability distribution it's you know, has support only around A, even though B is... You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Would that be a fast and light signaling problem?
Oh, right. To your point. I'm going to say no, but it's a good question. I can't think immediately of a technical explanation as to why. Yeah, it's a good question. I can't immediately give you a reason why it doesn't. yeah, Okay. So one thing you can do is try to account for why you have this. So again, Anthony Valentini has done a lot of work trying to say, well, even if you start off with some distribution like this, you start with rho not equal to psi squared times zero. And evolve. Then very quickly, under course spinning, go to size equals size squared. And rho is equal to size. And it has some very nice computer simulations. There's a paper by Valentini and Westman. Which shows that very quickly, after four or five cycles of a system, you'll get this effect. So it seems that even if in the early universe or whatever, the wave function distribution wasn't given by this, it seems that under normal physical processes, you will very quickly get a distribution. Let me come to some criticisms of this model. Now, first one is that you don't actually need the guidance equation to predict probabilities. Since you don't need the guidance equations to predict probabilities, and anyway, it's actually quite complicated to do the calculations, nobody's going to use this. Second criticism is, where does this guidance equation come from? It's kind of a bolt-on. Now, what would be nice would be to find some more general principles for obtaining all these equations. Starting for some sort of deeper considerations. Instead, what seems to happen is to take quantum theory as it's given, and then bolt this guidance condition on top of it because you want to solve the measurement problem. Seems, in a sense, the wrong way to go about physics.
There's never really any way of feeding back the information about the actual position of the particle into the into the wave function, except in like the, your choice of which effective wave function you pick.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So that sort of there's no back reaction that people often criticize. The wave function just evolves according to the Schrodinger equation. I mean, you can say it's effective wave function, but really the full wave function is evolving according to the Schrodinger equation. There's no back reaction. We'll just add that separately. And some people would argue that if physics tells us anything, it's that there should always be back reaction. If one thing influences another thing, then that thing should influence the first one. And then there's the many worlds in denial attack. This is the argument that really the de Broglie-Bohm model is just a many world model, but it's denying that fact. David Deutsch. And then there's a paper also by Harvey Brown and David Wallace. So we discussed this a little bit already, but the argument goes like this. The wave function is a real thing. Therefore, the empty wave packets are real, so the part of the wave function that doesn't have any particles in it is real. These empty packets. Well, they contain everything. They contain all sorts of things. They contain, what do I have here? They contain, you know, this room. They contain people doing things, going about their daily life. All that structure of the world is written into these empty wave packets. But according to the Broglie-Bohm model, nevertheless, that's not the world we experience. So you have basically zombies or mindless hulks. Those are the terms that appear in literature. This is the only course you're taking that has those words in it.
He has ghosts.
There are no ghosts. So it's kind of a problem. If the wave function is real, what we think of it is, I'm not a philosopher, but there is this, line of thinking in philosophy called functionalism. So the idea is that if you have some physical process happening, it only improves certain steps, then it doesn't really matter what you use, what type of physical system you use to instantiate that process. You still have all the properties that you would associate with that process. So it's used usually as an argument about consciousness. If you have a brain built out of carbon atoms and so on, neurons, going through some computational steps, and then you also have a computer doing the same things, then if the brain is conscious, then the computer should also be conscious. And likewise here, if you have this wave function stuff going through all the steps of, you know, people going about their lives, then this should be just as real, whether it's an empty wave function as a non-empty wave function. So it's very difficult to admit something into your ontology that is real, but then choose not to make it as real as the other stuff you admit into your ontology. And that's the move that the Boyd Bone model is trying to pull. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I'm not sure I understand what the empty wave packets are.
They're the things like over here that if your particle position, all your 10 to 20 to the 3 particles in your pointer went into, say, the A wave packet, then there's nothing over here mm-hmm. in the B wave packet. That's a wave packet, but it has no actual particles in the support of the other wave packet. So here's an example. Imagine if I tossed a quantum coin right here and now, and we all saw that we got heads. Okay, so it was a qubit, and I measured, and obviously we get a certain outcome. Okay, that would imply in this De Broglie Bohm model that we now live in the wave packets corresponding to my getting heads. So the wave packet product where I would have gone tails is still there, it's still a real thing, still a part of the wave function. But it doesn't have us in it.
Mm-hmm.
But it still has all the structure of this room. It's all there mathematically inside the wave function. It has exactly zonkers in there. This is a very good word for it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can you go over again what caused all of the particles to go to one of the sides?
So I didn't really give you a model. I did the model. I just sort of asserted that we imagine that wave function position up there,
uh-huh.
where it goes like that. But if you look at physical models, imagine a pointer. So my wife looks in the pointer. It's got many atoms in this pointer, and the pointer goes all this way or all that way. So obviously there's some aspects of the Hamiltonian that's making all these particles go one way or the other, and that has to do with the detail of the model.
So, let's say I have a similar picture like that, which corresponds to different decisions of mine, like decisions of my will. Does the model in fact say that there is no free will, or?
I'm not sure. So in a sense, this model is fundamentally deterministic. You have some initial wave function, beginning of the universe, whatever that means. And there's some fundamental Hamiltonian. And the wave function evolves unitarily, and the particles follow deterministic. So this model isn't a very good place for free will.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you look at the philosophy literature on free will, it's a very hard concept to pin down anyway. It's not clear that just having probabilities or randomness is enough to guarantee free will. You know, it's a bit like it's difficult. It's difficult really to make free will and physics compatible.
Mm-hmm.
Probabilities isn't sufficient to do that. So, but certainly, if you think that determinism and free will are incompatible, then this is a completely deterministic model. Any more? Questions. Sorry, I thought I'd get some time to move on to the Meadowalt interpretation. This is a natural departure point, but I won't. Because when this attack coming from these people, there's a lot more substance to it than I've given here. They have a really strong argument for saying that the empty wave packets are real. So I'm going to go through that. In the next lecture.
So these people are actually using this to support many worlds?
Yeah, so the image I like to give is that you've got these two camps. You've got the De Broglie Bohm people, and you've got the many worlds people. And this is a torpedo fired from the many worlds camp into the Deploy Bomb, and you can see the battleship sinking as a consequence. I think also we'll see that the Many Worlds battleship is also going to sink, but for different reasons. So this is sort of, you know, they destroy the Many Worlds before sinking themselves under the weight of their own excess metaphysics. So we'll carry on tomorrow with Many Worlds, hopefully.